3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, the band with the little three-letter name, a big lineup, an even bigger sound, and a vast musical legacy.
With 90125, we were cinema at that time, and John came in and it changed the whole validity of it, really, in so many ways. Because, you know, John has the unique voice of the band, and really, it, you know, that's what it is. And that's really when it becomes Yes, too.
The sound of Yes's harmonies is not John, it's John and Chris. And the others try, you know, get involved, but really no one else can sing. It's really John and Chris's voice that make the difference.
I think we were always into sort of uplifting music. You know, I personally didn't follow the Stones into their satanic realm. I followed the Beatles into All You Need Is Love. Lift me up and turn me over. Lead me on into the
dawn. Magnification. I'm Alan White of Yes with Redbeard.
I'm John Anderson of Yes with Redbeard.
I'm Tony Kaye of Yes.
This is Trevor Raven of Yes. You're in the studio.
When we left off in part one, the second era of the British progressive rockers Yes, comprised of band co-founders John Anderson and Chris Squire, with latest recruits Rick Wakeman, Steve Howe, and Alan White, had the number one selling album in the UK and America with Close to the Edge. Indicative of the heady times at the peak of the progressive rock era, Yes chose to follow up with a multi-disc live album and then a four-sided studio opus called Tales from Topographic Oceans in 74. Talking to Yes drummer Alan White and guitarist Steve Howe, I wondered aloud if there was a music label on the planet today that would give any band that kind of carte blanche. Alan White goes first in the studio.
I don't know. It was a different world then. We'd have ideas for songs and all go in and play them until the album was completed.
Yeah, in 1970, we all lived in England. Yeah. You know, the sound of the group was consistently British. Because we used to make records, we used to go in and we'd have a month and then we'd do a few shows and then we'd have another month. And we used to make records either in a four-month block, like Topographic took 4 months, that was considered at the time.
There was four sides of music?
Yeah.
4 months?
And that was incredibly short by today's standards.
It was crazy to do that amount of time in a studio.
But then Paul Simon recorded Bridge Over Troubled Waters, the album, and that took a year, and that kind of set a whole new precedent. I mean, it meant that every musician now could take a year to do his album, because that's how you did an album that good.
To shape for all time.
absolutely spine-tingling vocal performance by John Anderson and a gorgeous melody and arrangement on the song Soon, which appeared on the Yes album Relayer, also in 1974. But all was not well in or out of the band. They were on their third keyboard player, Patrick Moratz, after Rick Wakeman went on a solo sabbatical. And the next almost 10 years found diminishing returns and band member defections in the wake of the punk rock and so-called new wave bands who found Yes an easy target. By 1981, the band had disbanded and the members scattered. There were some promising but ultimately false starts, such as Alan White and Chris Squire demoing music with Led Zeppelin guitar great Jimmy Page for the working title of XYZ, but it was nixed by managers. Then the White Squire rhythm section hooked up with young South African singer-songwriter guitarist Trevor Rabin, along with original Yes keyboard player Tony Kaye, and calling themselves Cinema. They were almost ready to finish a complete album they had worked on for the better part of a year when Chris Squire played the Cinema recordings for his old friend John Anderson, who was so impressed that John volunteered to sing these songs himself. Trevor Rabin admits that while flattered that Anderson was so excited by the Cinema songs, it did put Trevor Rabin in an awkward spot.
There was parts of it which I felt were a little peculiar, because I was just so unaccustomed to hearing John singing my songs, obviously. Then he sang Hearts, which is, I think, the last track on the second side, and I really liked it. And we spoke, and he joined the band, and only at that point, which was, you know, out of 9 months, was the last month of the album. And that was at which point we called the band Yes.
When I asked Cinema keyboard player Tony Kaye about his initial reaction, John Anderson jumped in first.
Shock. Oh, it's him again.
It was a shock to the system. It was a shock to the system, him again.
It's so natural and so obvious, you know, that it's not a shock at all. You know, it happened with 90125. We were Cinema at that time, and John came in, and it changed the whole validity of it, really, in so many ways. Because, you know, John has the unique voice of the band, and really, it, you know, that's what it is. And that's really when it becomes Yes, too.
We'll be right back. Chris Squire and Trevor Rabin join me in the studio to discuss their comeback as Yes on the album 90125.
What's evolved in the band's attitude that would allow you to even consider putting out this song with that arrangement and having the name Yes on it?
Well, I think it's got quite a lot to do with him, Trevor, that is. I mean, you know, especially based on the back of when Trevor joined the band and we got Owner of a Lonely Heart to number one. That, for the same reason at the time, also gained a lot of interest because people thought, God, that's Yes, you know, doing this. And it was basically a kind of a dance rock song. Funnily enough, after that, like, more rock songs became dance oriented, it seemed. But so we kind of set a little pattern there. But I think that's because we do take chances, and that's probably why we're still around, you know.
Good point. But you know, we always have thought of you as taking chances to the left field, to the outer reaches. It's interesting to have the confidence, the talent, to revisit potentially the same neighborhood that you were in with Owner.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of liked the neighborhood when you were number one, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of the time people assume that there's this contrived or organized system that we have of doing a record, and really it's totally disorganized, untogether. Nobody knows from one minute to the next what's going on.
And you're damn proud of it.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you know, with Owner, I mean, it was a song that I didn't even intend to play to the band. And when the, you know, and I was kind of thumbing through songs kind of thing for us to get into or not. And when Owner came up and said, yeah, and that's, you know, all credit to Chris and, you know, and Alan and taking the chance after their heritage of Yes to delve into that area. Because, you know, had it gone the wrong way, you know, it could have been whipped and lashed for doing that.
Absolutely.
By the diehard Yes fans, but it turned out to be the right thing, and I think that's the tradition of, it's like, yeah, let's go for it, it works.
To you.
selling over 4 million in the U.S. alone, the album 90125 by Yes was one of the biggest comebacks in music history. I'm Redbeard. Up next, Steve Howe, Alan White, John Anderson, and Tony Kaye all rejoin us in the studio.
I'm John Anderson of Yes, with Redbeard.
I'm Tony Kaye of Yes.
This is Trevor Raven of Yes. You're in the studio.
Thank you all. The big band with the little three-letter name decided to follow their enormous comeback with 90125 and the subsequent world tour with the album Big Generator in 1987. Here's Yes guitarist Steve Howe, followed by drummer Alan White.
It's sort of musical mayhem, if you like. Trevor Horn had a lovely way of putting it. He said the epitome of Yes is to try and do the impossible and make it work. And like very often, the things that we did, like three lines going at once and somebody else singing. And,
you get shell shock afterwards.
It isn't a thing that a lot of groups want to do or maybe could do or would care to do, but it happens, so happens that this group called Yes that's changed, evolved a lot, has always wanted to do what other people don't want to do. It's almost like the most obstinate group you could find.
Didn't always work. I mean, some things were like,
oh no, sometimes it's
so chaotic it was,
and sometimes it's become more accessible, you know, and that also, I mean, that's part of its changing, if you like. When I was in Asia, funny enough, Yes were becoming more like a group that were actually going for the charts but wanting to keep the ideas that they had, but developing. I mean, in a way, in the 70s, we never really thought like that. It was, but I appreciate how much the 80s were very different from the 70s, and the concession, not really concessions, but the necessity for a group to carry on successfully is that if it's not successful, they won't carry on. Now, if you've got that as a challenge, look, if the group's not successful, we've got to stop. And the group's got to be successful because you've got to keep it going. So in a way, you have to find out how to keep it going, and part of that is having success, which is the thing everybody wants, especially in LA. So it's like you're trying to do the impossible again, but in a way, without playing music that would cheapen the idea of what Yes is.
Sometimes falls apart.
Rhythm of Love comes from the 1987 Yes Big Generator album, but the big expectations for it exceeded actual sales. Like water finding every crack, the old creative and personality conflicts reared up once again, with lead singer John Anderson leaving again and taking guitarist Steve Howe with him to join former Yes men Rick Wakeman and Bill Bruford to record and tour as...
Yeah, Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman and Howe. It's like a firm of solicitors, you know.
Yeah, a law firm, right?
Yeah, you can't get a longer name than that.
No.
So it just seemed... it was just a tag, really. But inside... You know, people would ask me, what do I do? And I say, you know, I'm a musician, I work in a group. What's the group called? I always say yes. The most important thing for me was seeing two sides of the coin. I had a 90125 big generator group, and which is an incredibly powerful unit with Alan, Chris, and Trevor, and Tony. And to work with Steve and Rick and Bill again, and we had Tony Levin on bass, there was a lot of finesse there. And in some ways, I could say, well, I miss the heaviness of Chris and Trevor and Alan. And then when I'm with Chris and Trevor and Alan, sometimes I miss a little finesse. It's just the way the makeup of these musicians is extraordinary. And I was very fortunate to work with both teams.
So then it got really crazy for the 1991 album Union. Keyboardist Tony Kaye joins John Anderson and me in the studio.
Just like he appeared during the 90125 album.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I think in many ways we kind of stumble along.
It's true. Looking for an opening.
And looking for an opening.
It's like
and,
getting a table
and
in a restaurant.
I don't think anyone really. I don't think anyone really thinks about it. It's not like... You know, the phone calls are made.
Yeah. It would never happen
like that. It has to happen by stumbling along and even if it's separately, to go through a period of writing music. And then somehow at the end of that period, just like it did in 90125 and probably before in certain ways, different ways, it stumbles along to the necessary right conclusion.
Calling, calling.
Composers Trevor Rabin and the late Chris Squire discussed the song Lift Me Up.
And once again, you know, lyrically in the verse, a little dark. You know, we try to make a somewhat vague as to what it's about, but one of the pictures is that it's, you know, a homeless person, and, you know, I look around, I've got nowhere to stay. You know, you look me up, you look me down. The guy, you know, the guy who goes into the restaurant to use the bathroom, and they look at him, no, you can't come in here. And then he just looks to the sky, lift me up and turn me over, you know, help me out. So
that's actually
landing
really,
up,
it actually is pretty specifically
specific, but we didn't mention specifically homeless because, you know, it could be about...
Keeps it broader.
It a little broader, but that's what it was intended for. You know, that's how we kind of...
Focus.
That was the focus, yeah.
I think definitely the Yes theme has always been a hopeful one. I think, you know rather than light and dark, I think we've used... dark expressionism in order to show the difference between good and evil, or light and dark, which, you know, whichever way it is, but usually even if the songs refer to darkness, it's because there's a positive attitude at the end of it, you know.
Still to come, Trevor Rabin and Chris Squire there are joined by John Anderson. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net for even more. I'm Redbeard, In the Studio with Ultimate Yes Part 2.
I'm Alan White of Yes with Redbeard.
I'm John Anderson of Yes with Redbeard.
I'm Tony Kaye of Yes.
This is Trevor Rabin of Yes. You're in the studio.
And heartiest congratulations to you all on your induction of Yes into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Band co-founder John Anderson sums up the nebulous legacy of Yes.
What I've always said, that Yes is something that hovers above the collective unit and keeps us in tow, keeps us working hard, and keeps our spirits in the right direction in order to make good music with a defined idea, and not to just jump and try to make a hit single. The single market is very, very difficult to understand, difficult to to ascertain. You know, one minute you're major famous and the next minute you're nothing. I'd rather make 10 good albums than one hit single. You know, it's one of those things that when the Yes idea first came, we would talk only album music.
Open your eyes and ears to Chris Squire, Trevor Rabin, and John Anderson with me in the studio.
How important is the music to this?
No, it's the same. Of course it is. It's the main thing that's that holds it all together. I mean, the love of the music and the enjoyment of actually, I think probably Trevor will agree with me on this, of going on stage and having a really good show and playing it. You know, it's a very uplifting thing. It definitely is what keeps us, you know, driven to do another thing, because, you know, that's a great feeling when you get to that point. Probably more than, you know, making a record.
Absolutely. But I think I agree with Chris that the music is the center of it all, and yes, it is the thing that holds it together. But it's also the thing that pulls it apart. You know.
No, I don't know, and I'm not being.
Well, because one of the things that I found, you know, from when I first, you know, from joining the band and joining up, when it, even before John joined, with it being cinema, is, and the thing that I enjoyed most about working with Chris, besides his talent, was he's kind of he's not really a compromising kind of guy, and very often we'd have heated moments, and go home that night and say, oh God, you know, I'm glad we got the weekend off. I don't have to deal with that tomorrow. But, you know, not having him around, I kind of miss it, you know, because it's very important. I think that relationship is very important. You know, it's something that brings out what it is we do. And then you put John into the equation. I'm talking about the 901-5 thing. And it kind of confuses it even further.
It certainly makes it more complex.
But far more frustrating. But at the end of the day, we all, you know, it's a very rewarding thing. And, you know, it would be much easier for Chris to go off and do an album on his own, or for me to, or for John to. But it wouldn't sound the same as when we're all working together. It doesn't. Something happens when we work together. And that's why I think it takes us a long time to do things. Not because we want to, but because it takes as long as the music demands us to take, kind of thing.
Yes, co-founder John Anderson.
I think we were always into sort of uplifting music. You know, I personally didn't follow the Stones into their satanic realm. I followed the Beatles into All You Need Is Love. That was my dream. I loved it. And I tended to follow that train of thought, even though I saw the Stones last year and it was great. You know,
they
were just the best.
They were the best.
It's something, I think what Tony said earlier, we seem to, like a magnet towards, we're sort of driven to write this kind of music, and it's not even soul-searching. It's very spirited music in many ways, and very the love of life, the love and need for understanding, ecology, and you become part and parcel of the people. You're with the people. They want to hear their train of thought put into musical form. That's why they come and see a concert. And we need them to affirm that we're doing the right thing. And the word yes is that affirmation. And it's an umbrella in which we all survive.
Days that we speak, I believe that you were right. Shouldn't chase the demons and the phantoms of the night. Some treat us lovers, some treat us slaves. Of insight is all that we imagine. Speak to me clearly, you're the magnet to my soul. I get so distracted trying to reason with it all. Like the people, I'm clinging to the edge of every world, spinning in creation, so afraid to let my feelings really show. Justify, to magnify, to realize that everything is love.
cut down to a four-piece in September 2001 with Magnification, a magnificent album arranged with sweeping full orchestration. This edition of In the Studio is dedicated to Yes co-founder Chris Squire, the only member to have appeared on every Yes album. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this.